Welcome to The Book Show with me, Sinead Gleeson. On this evening's show, we speak to John Ronson about Frank, which opened this week in cinemas.
Snakes came into our Garden of Eden in the form of everyone around us becoming extremely successful while we stayed at exactly the same level.
And we look at a new way to get published with crowdsourced funding and Unbound.
We let authors come up with ideas and they pitch that idea on a website. They don't have to have written it, they just have to have the idea. And you can pledge money in advance.
But first this evening, the art of co-writing. Paul Perry and Karen Galise are both established writers in their own right, but together they write under the name Karen Perry. The Boy That Never Was is their first collaboration, and in it, Harry and Robin's married life is irrevocably changed when their son Dylan disappears. And this is Paul Perry reading from the opening chapter of the novel, where the main character Harry, who's in Tangier, leaves his small son alone as he goes to visit a neighbour.
Taking one last look at the sleeping child, he hurries down the stairs and into the empty bookshop, which is cast in shadow now that the evening light is fading and the sky beyond has grown dark and brooding. He steps outside, locking the door behind him, and strides purposefully through the narrow street. The lingering quiet in the streets unnerves him. He looks up and catches sight of a veiled woman peering down at him. Quickly, she draws back from the window, disappearing from view. Somewhere nearby in the warren of alleyways, a dog is barking, and he cannot shake the sense of unease. The gin, instead of taking the edge off things, has somehow sharpened his anxiety. But what has he to be anxious about? He has left the boy alone. Pangs of guilt make him increase his pace, and he half walks, half runs to the corner.
And that was Paul Perry reading from the novel The Boy That Never Was. And Karen Galise and Paul Perry join me now in studio. It's a gripping opening passage and it's set in Tangier. And I think a lot of people will think of, you know, disappeared children in a country far away from Ireland and think of the Madeleine McCann story. Was that horror, that kind of horrific story that we all knew very well, was it an inspiration in any way for this book?
I wouldn't say it was a direct inspiration, but certainly it was in our minds when we sat down to talk about Harry and Robin and their predicament.
Yeah, when we started talking about what we wanted to write about, we decided, because we are both parents of young children, we wanted to write about parental fear. And for me, that's one of my greatest fears, that one of my girls will go missing. And I remember when my daughter was very small, only a few weeks old, and I was out. People are so past remarkable when you have a small baby. And someone said to me, oh, you know, that little girl, she's so beautiful. Don't take your eyes off her for a second. And it was such a scary thing to say, because it taps into that fear, that innate fear you have as a parent, that someone will take your child or your child will go missing under some strange circumstances. So while the Madeleine McCann case, I mean, it's so huge, but there have been many incidents of missing children. I mean, I grew up in Rathfarnham and Philip Cairns went missing when I was a little girl. And so from a young age, I was very aware of this missing child phenomenon as such. So yeah, when we came to talk about what we wanted to write about, the missing child thing came out very much to the fore.
Mm-hmm. Both of your work is obviously very different from this combined book. I think people will know you more, Paul, as a poet. But did you feel at all that you were out of your comfort zone when you were writing this book?
I think that's a fair description. and that was part of the challenge and the excitement. We set ourselves to write a compelling commercial psychological thriller, which, as you say, is out of both our genres. To me, though, it became more about the characters, Harry and Robin. And working together, of course, it's out of our comfort zone. And yet, as I say, that was part of the excitement and the frisson between us collaboratively, I think, helped generate the excitement within the book.
How did you guys meet? And then how did you go from being friends and, you know, individual writers to deciding we're going to write a book together?
Well, we met at Listowel Writers' Week about 11 years ago, mm-hmm. I think, 11 or 12 years ago now. And it was just one of those random meetings that happens all the time at Listowel, where you're sitting in a pub and you turn and start talking to the person next to you. And that's simply how we met. And we stayed friends over the years. And then one evening, about 2 years ago now, 2.5 years ago, we were meeting for a pint in Neary's. And Paul suggested that we have a go at writing a novel together. And as everything in life, it's all about timing. For me, it was the right timing for such a question to be put to me, such a proposition to be put to me, because I felt a need for a change in my writing life. I found the writing of my fourth novel quite difficult, and I was looking around for something different to do. And at the time I was writing this historical fiction novel, and when Paul suggested we try this collaborative fiction, I thought, well, that's something else I can also try. And so we approached it as very much as a writing experiment, and something that we weren't going to take too seriously. You know, we wanted it to be fun and enjoyable. But very soon into the writing process, we realised that we were onto something, and it just seemed to take on a life of its own, kind of swamping everything else that we were working on creatively.
I think when people think about co-writing projects, we wonder how it actually works. But how you tell the story in this book, I think probably the structure helps, and that you tell it from alternative points of view. So how did you do it? And is there a lot of back and forth? How do you write a book with somebody?
Well, that's exactly what it is. It's back and forth. So chapter one was written first, and that's Harry in Dublin, November 2010. There's a demonstration against the government, against austerity measures. And I was in town that day, and I saw the helicopters, and I saw the people marching, and I thought, here we are, this could be chapter one. I went home and wrote it, sent it to Karen, not really knowing what she would do with chapter one, whether she would respond at all. But she sent back a fabulous chapter two, and it felt like that relay writing had started, and it was like a fuse had been lit, and we wrote the first draft very quickly.
This isn't your first experience of co-writing, Paul. How did it work out before? How did you...
Right, yes. Again, about 10 years ago, I was living in Longford, and as a writer in residence, you're coming up with creative ideas that are outside of the workshop experience. So I pitched an idea to the arts officer of a collaborative novel. 10 writers wrote this high farce called Goldsmith's Ghost, which ended at the Goldsmith Summer School. And it was great fun. I had been aware of other precedents. Finbar's Hotel at Dermot Bulger had edited, but all the way back into the 20th, 19th century, even with Henry James writing a collaborative novel, and even Mark Twain and Charles Dickens collaborating with Wilkie Collins. So the notion of collaboration had always interested me.
In terms of the idea of actually doing it, the process, how do you work out the knots and the problems in terms of, say, with a story like this, there's got to be revelations all the way through the book. So how do you sort of drip feed that, and who decides on when things are revealed, how characters, what direction they go off in? I mean, if you don't agree on something, what do you do?
Well, there are disagreements, but we haven't had any serious disagreements yet. Well, there's a lot of discussion involved. There's a lot of almost negotiation involved in writing a collaborative novel. So we would meet regularly, we would talk regularly on the phone, and we would try and hammer out the main plot points. So we would have an idea of the general shape of the novel. So where the story arc rises and where it dips again and where it rises again. And so we would try and find the structure first. But we would allow each other a certain amount of freedom as well to deviate from the planned structure, because I think you need that creative space. And if something feels right, and if you feel like you need to deviate from the plot, then you should be allowed to do it. And I think it makes it a much better book. So occasionally we would have certain disagreements, but we would just chat about it, and you'd argue your case. But then sometimes you might see, actually, you know what, the other person is right. This isn't working. This needs to be taken out or changed.
In that sense, it's very much like the editorial process, mm-hmm. because we've got an editor in London, we've got an editor in New York, and they have different ideas about the book as well. You've got line editors and copy editors. So it is very much a collaborative effort in the end.
I'm interested in the gender dynamic and whether it's important, and that would either of you have done this with a friend of the same sex, maybe. I mean, I know it's been Nikki French as a sort of male-female, John Connolly and Jenny Ridgeard have recently done this as well. But how did it have an impact on it?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I think because it's a husband and wife, it made sense for us to write individually in our own genders. But what we did in...
You're not husband and wife.
No, we're not.
But what we did in subsequent rewrites was that we rewrote each other's chapters. Mm. And I think that's something we learned from Nikki French.
Yeah. I think the key to collaborative writing is finding the right person to collaborate with, be they man or woman. And I think that it's a personality issue as much as it is a literary issue or a taste or style issue. that I think that our personalities work together in a working relationship. Don't you agree?
You have to agree.
It's a literary marriage of sorts. Yeah, yeah.
Thanks so much to Karen Gillies and Paul Perry. The Boy That Never Was by Karen Perry is published by Penguin Michael Joseph. Now, it's very common these days to see short films, CDs, theatre productions, all funded through crowdsourcing, and a UK publishing company, Unbound, is now helping writers to get their work published through an online funding platform. Zoe Cummins met with the editors to find out more.
Good morning, Unbound. Hello, how are you? Excellent. Brilliant. Well, that's exactly when we said it would be ready. Fantastic. Great, okay.
That's John Mitchison, one of the three founders of Unbound.
I've seen the book trade from every angle.
He started as a bookseller.
So actually started on the shop floor in Waterstones, and I ended up becoming marketing director.
Then became a publisher, and now...
And then I spent the last 10 years writing scripts and books for QI.
Fellow QI writer, historical advisor and author, Justin Pollard is the director of crowdfunding.
I'd written 10 books, but my background's television and film, and I advise on feature films, on the history behind feature films.
To complete the trio of founders is Dan Kiernan, with equally impressive credentials as the author of 9 books.
Unbound started with the three of us literally in a pub moaning about publishing. And we were all very aware that lots of our friends and peers were having real problems getting their books out.
And it seemed to me that there was still a huge gap, that the relationship between the readers, the people who were buying the books and reading them, and writers just seemed to me to be, there were too many steps in that chain.
So it seemed natural to us to try and change publishing, and it seemed natural for us that we were the people that should have a crack at it.
And in my enthusiasm, I then went and told Terry Jones, who I'd been writing for some years before, and Terry, being a great iconoclast, said, I've got a book you can have. And I left that pub, another pub meeting, and rang up Dan and had to say, you know that idea we had? I think we might actually have to do it now, because we've got a book from one of Monty Python. So it was it's Terry's fault, really, that we then had to actually stop complaining and actually turn round and start doing it. So that was sort of ultimately, Monty Python proved to be the genesis of Unbound.
I'll tell you what's wrong with you. Your head's addled with novels and poems. You come home every evening reeling of Chateau Latour.
Oh, don't, be careful. You know what he's like after a few novels.
Unbound is the first company to tackle the crowdsourcing space. It's got a completely different business model to a conventional publisher.
Compared to a traditional publisher who goes out and finds an author and pays in advance, gets them to write the book and then sells it and hopes to earn back the advance and make a profit, we let authors come up with ideas and they pitch that idea on a website. They don't have to have written it, they just have to have the idea.
Supporters then log on to the site and pledge money to the idea.
And if enough money is brought in to then make that idea happen, then we produce the book.
Subscribers get their name in the back of the book.
They actually made it happen. They weren't a passive consumer. They're someone who actually invested in making a creative work come to life.
But how do the founders sort the good submissions from bad?
Certainly currently we're not an entirely open platform in that you can't, whoever you are, whatever you've come up with, just put your idea on Unbound. We have a team of editors and we curate. We go out looking for work, and also we have submissions that come into us which all get read, and we go through all of those and we find those authors who we know have a pedigree and who we'd love to have on Unbound. We find those new authors who we think have real talent, but it's not a case that we will publish anything anyone wants. Because otherwise we would have millions of books on the site, and how would you ever find the real talent within that?
To use internet jargon, this really is the long tail of the internet, where niche rather than mass-produced books are available, and this is a boost for writers.
Now, there are lots of authors who didn't get famous until their 6th or 7th books, and a traditional publishing house wouldn't do that anymore. They wouldn't support someone like Ian Rankin for those number of projects before the book became famous, before he became famous. So we think we're a very important ecosystem, actually, for writers to be discovered and to work before they get their hits.
Traditional publishing is a notoriously slow process. So how long does it take for an Unbound book to get funded and onto the shelves?
We don't set very strict deadlines on you have 30 days in which to fund this or not, because it depends very much on the subject. A lot of authors start writing whilst they're funding, because they're confident, which is great. But again, we've had books that have taken 2 years to actually turn into a full physical in-the-shops book. It's not a case of get them out as quickly as possible.
So at the moment we're looking at a project page for Robert Llewellyn's book News from the Clouds, and Robert Llewellyn is famously Crichton in Red Dwarf and does Scrap Heap Challenge and some fantastic TV shows online. He's a real online pioneer, actually, and he was one of the first authors to get in touch with us. And this is a really good example. News from the Clouds is actually the third book in a trilogy. So he started off by writing News from Gardenia, and it got funded incredibly quickly. It was very popular. It did very, very well on the site. And then his readers demanded he write a sequel. And this is a brilliant example of the way Unbound works. His readers pressured him into doing something else. And he was very happy to. I mean, don't get me wrong. They didn't have to twist his arm. He was delighted.
For each of the authors on the site, there's a shed where you can find out where the author is at in the process. And using the skills within the company, there's an ad for the book.
Imagine if it was really windy. I mean, really windy, so that a mere gale was like a calm day. Imagine if it was really hot. I mean, really stinking, skin-burned, scorching hot every single day of the year, and it never rained.
You're in a bookshop and your book is spying on a shelf, and you've got a little bit of blurb on the back to sell the idea to a reader. We make commercials for our books, and then you can read the synopsis and read an extract, and then you can find out about the author.
Bitter Arctic blasts most of the year.
We actually think this is a much better way of selling a book, and it speaks to the audience in the way they expect now.
And how much do the authors get?
Once the book has been successfully funded, we've covered all the costs. And then all the profits that we subsequently get from selling the book in bookshops and ebooks, we split 50-50 with the author. And that is exactly the same for every author we have ever had, whether you're a first-time author or a big name. It's just our principle. This is a joint venture. We're doing it together. We're both going to work as hard as each other to make this happen. People are just so excited to look under the bonnet of publishing and see actually what's happening. Everyone loves to know what's going on behind the scenes.
Thanks there to Zoe Cummins and the publishers Unbound. If you want to get published or find out more about what they do, log on to unbound.co.uk. Now, Frank, the new film by Lenny Abramson and starring Michael Fassbender and Maggie Gyllenhaal was released in Irish cinemas this week. The film was inspired by a book written by John Ronson, who I chatted to recently and began by asking him who Frank Sidebottom actually was.
He was an avant-garde comedy musician in Manchester in the 1980s, was his, like, his heyday, and he wore a big fake head and nobody knew his true identity. And under the head, nobody knew, he had like a nose pick, so he could sing like that. And he would do kind of weird, repetitive cover versions of pop classics like I Should Be So Lucky or Material World. And I got to join his band. I got to be the keyboard player for 3 years. I was kind of plucked from obscurity, like Alice through the Looking Glass, to become his keyboard player. And it was an amazing. As I say in the book, nothing makes a young man feel more alive and on an adventure than speeding down the M6 at 2 a.m. next to a man wearing a big fake head.
You paint a very unglamorous picture of life on the road in the book.
Well, actually, I mean, at the time, my expectations for life were extremely low. And so to me, crisscrossing between Bradford and Leeds and Manchester in a transit van, playing to, like, you know, 300 people, 400 people, was greater kudos than I ever imagined possible. I mean, I'd come from Cardiff where I'd had, like, you know, pretty rough time of it, and so it was kind of, so at the time it felt just brilliant, but then I don't know, the kind of snakes came into our Garden of Eden in the form of everyone around us becoming extremely successful while we stayed at exactly the same level. So our driver decided to have a career in radio, and he was Chris Evans, and my next door neighbour's band, you know, was the Stone Roses, and you know, everyone was getting more and more famous, and so in the end, I think we were kind of perverted by that. I think we were, you know, I think we were, yeah, we were Eve wanting to put on, I don't want to go too far down this Garden of Eden thing, but Eve wanting to put on clothes and wanting to be more successful kind of destroyed us, I think.
But you paint this picture as a sort of anti-fame story in the book, and you know, he was very much on the margins. But why did you think it would make a good story, and why did you want to tell it?
Well, like 15 years later, after he fired me for tax reasons and I moved back to London, he telephoned out of the blue So by then I was like, I had a young son and we were in the park, and suddenly I, you know, the phone rings, this voice goes, "Hello!" I said, "Frank?" It had been 15 years, maybe even longer. And he said he was staging a comeback, and would I write something? I thought this was going to be like a sort of Blues Brothers scenario, that he'd say, "I was staging a comeback, and, you know, I'm going to put the old band together." He never asked me to be in the old band again. He just wanted me to write something. So I wrote something in The Guardian. And it did have a rather lovely kind of Alice in Wonderland quality to it, this piece that I wrote. It was like a fairy tale, you know, getting to be in this band. And so my friend Peter Strawn, who's a screenwriter who wrote the screenplay for The Men Stay at Goats, which was one of my books, said we should make a film out of this. And in the end, the film became much more, became fictional, about somebody, like a kind of, you know, gross version of me being in a band with a man with a big fake head who's kind of inspired by Frank but isn't actually Frank. And the film's now been made with Michael Fassbender and Donald Gleeson, directed by Lenny Abrahamson. And so I thought, A, I really felt wistful for those old times. And B, I felt there was a really interesting morality story to be written about why it's okay to be marginal and how it's kind of corrosive to try and, you know, reach frantically for the mainstream. And C, because the Frank film, the Lenny Abrahamson Frank film, is completely fictional, I thought it would be really good to just put down the true story that inspired the movie. So for those three reasons. And I think D, I was feeling a little bit miserable. I was living in New York, with not quite as many friends as I have in cities where I, you know, actually belong. And so I was feeling kind of sad for the old times. So I spent a really cold winter writing it.
How did the story change, and what were the difficulties going from a piece of journalism to a book to a film?
Well, I mean, for me, it was like it was a kind of extraordinary and really difficult situation. I tell you, the first time I noticed that this was going to be a really weird experience for me was that in real life, it was Frank who wanted to be more mainstream. He was kind of sick of everyone around us getting famous, and he wanted to be more mainstream. And Peter Strawn, my screenwriter friend, said to me, "You know, I think it'd be better if John, for the screenplay, it'd be better if John was the one who wants to make the band more mainstream." And that was like a huge, you know, as a journalist, you never think like that, right? It's a complete. It was alien to me. It's like landscape gardening, and it took me years actually to get my head around it. You know, we wrote the screenplay for like 5 or 6 years, and it took me years because, as I say in the book, you know, if you go into a restaurant as a journalist, anything that happens in the restaurant is your story. But if you go into a restaurant as a fiction writer, there's no restaurants. There's like acres of nothingness. Then you then have to sort of fill it. And then you have to work out. It's like getting Monopoly without the rule book. You have to work out the rules. You have to invent the rules to make it more like a piece of journalism, I suppose. You know, these characters have to exist in a way that then you can then know what they would or wouldn't do in any given situation. It took me years and years and years, but finally I think I got to a place where I felt comfortable with it. And I think we have written a good screenplay, mainly because I had Lenny and Peter helping me, who were really versed in that. You know, I wasn't. And then as soon as the screenplay was finished, that's it, they go and make the film.
Is there a sense, because people know you as a journalist and a documentary maker and a writer, all of your work is in the realm of nonfiction, and this is your first attempt, I suppose, at fictionalising something, does this mean that John Ronson might one day write a novel?
No, I don't. I think I just can't imagine that. I think, you know what, there's one thing I'm good at, and that is I go into a situation and I just kind of know, both instinctively at the time and also when I've got all the material and I'm working on it back in my room, what the good bits are and what the boring bits are. And I'm just, I just know that. And it comes really easily and naturally to me. And I think that's like enough, you know, for a lifetime, is to be able to do narrative nonfiction well. I was really impressed with Peter and Lenny at their ability to kind of conjure things up from nothing. And I sort of managed to do it myself in the last couple of years of writing the screenplay. But I sort of think, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, unless I think my non-fiction life isn't broken.
Well, your non-fiction life, I mean, there's been the military, there's been psychopaths, the diversity of what you've covered is very, very broad. So what is it about something that makes you think it will turn into a good book, a good story? What draws you to a subject?
I think mystery to solve. So a world which I'm genuinely passionate about solving a mystery within. So with the Menestay at Goats, it was like, is there really, you know, was the US military really trying out all this paranormal stuff, trying to walk through walls and become invisible and kill goats just by staring at them? And with the psychopath test, you know, is it really true, as these kind of Harvard psychologists say, that psychopaths rule the world, that, you know, this particular brain anomaly is so powerful it's remoulded society all wrong? So then I kind of go into the world and hang around in it and meet people until I solve that mystery. It's great but not essential if there's an unfolding narrative. It's great if the people are interesting and if you can make it funny, but it has to be about something that matters. I think those are all the ingredients. And all that's coming together, I think, quite well for the book I'm writing at the moment as well, which is about public shaming, about people who've been publicly shamed. And I suppose the mystery of that book is why it's more about us, the shamers, I think, than it is about the shamees. It's like, why are we all so keen to just reduce people to their flaws? What's that all about?
And thanks to John Ronson. Frank, the true story that inspired the movie is published by Picador. Well, that brings us to the end of another show. Thanks to producer Zoe Cummins, and we'll leave you with Regan Hutchins and this footnote about the return of publishers Pelican.
In 1937, Penguin published George Bernard Shaw's The Intelligent Woman's Guide to Socialism, Capitalism, Sovietism and Fascism. It was the first of their now famous Blue Pelicans. The imprint was established to cheaply improve the minds of the masses, and the books introduced readers to an enormous range of topics such as statistics, town planning, anthropology, and sex education. They sold in their millions, and their various designs throughout the decades are fetishized. They slipped easily into back pockets, littered bedsit floors, and were essential for posing until 1990, when, to great disappointment, the series was discontinued. Penguin is relaunching the blue-spined brand this month with contributions on economics, Russia, and the classical world. The publisher clearly believes that in this age of the mouse, information can also be delivered by the pelican.